Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've got Paul with us, and we're going to be diving into the Whiskey Rebellion. Excuse me. And so, Paul, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me, GR. This is going to be an interesting topic because I've studied this before, and over time, there's been a lot of sympathy for the Whiskey Rebellion. But in the context of the Constitution, maybe there's a different way to look at this.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of ways to look at this. And what to do when, you know, when there's an insurrection. Because bottom line, there's nobody that can dispute that the federal government has the authority to apply excise taxes. And we're going to go through this, and historically, they end up repealing this tax. But guess what? We have this excise tax on all liquor now today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we have an excise tax on beer and, you know, wine and those types of things. But, I think there are imposts on imported.
Right.
But maybe we don't tax our wine and brew. But all distilled liquors, all of those types of products are taxed. And so, mm-hmm. you know, they couldn't get away with it then because they were staples. And we actually talked about that as well, that whiskey was considered like milk. Go ahead.
Right. It was, you know, I think it was almost tradable like money. Mm-hmm. You know how they used tobacco had been used for trade?
Yep.
I think whiskey was like that too.
Yes. Yeah. So it was a staple because they didn't have refrigeration, and it was like having a soup. It was like having liquid bread. You know, it was your basic grain that you needed in the wintertime, which means that, okay, so instead of eating bread, you know, let's look at the cycle too, because this goes along with, you know, my show on Christmas about how Christmas, you know, was a winter holiday that was actually a wilding, and, you know, how it basically became manipulated into a Christian holiday. But when we look at the cycle of life and, you know, the productivity in their time span, you know, they were probably done eating fresh wheat and so forth, you know, probably mm-hmm. right there by December time frame.
So here's the other thing that's weird to me, okay? Whiskey is a staple. You're saying whiskey, you use the term whiskey as liquid bread. Now, I know what whiskey's made out of, all right? But let's say how did you apply whiskey? I mean, I can't see them feeding it to their kids. How did they apply whiskey as a staple in the winter? You know, I'm trying to wrap my head around this.
They did give their kids alcoholic beverages back in those days. I mean, John Adams lived on hard apple cider. He had hard apple cider every day from his, you know, from his childhood even into his adulthood.
Because
that's the only way you could have it preserved is by allowing it to, you know, be basically ferment.
Right, they didn't have refrigeration.
Now, the whiskey tax, we're not talking about this, you know, 18-year aged or anything like that, and distilled to the way we do it today. It was not nearly the alcohol content that we see in many of the scotches, bourbons, you know, and so forth. It was a much lower alcohol content.
Oh, so this really was a deeply serious effect on the people, because, you know, I have a better understanding, because when you think of our concept of whiskey, okay, I mean, I don't know that many homes that that many people that are whiskey consumers, and certainly we don't feed it to our kids. Okay.
Right.
So we live in such a different time that it's important to understand the context of what it meant in their time.
Right. Now, there were some that may have had, you know, a little bit of stores of grain or what have you, but not everybody. Most people, you know, the only thing that they could get, because, so the farmers, let's look at the farmers. The farmers had big paydays because they earned all their money at the harvest.
Correct.
And so they had what we would call a floating capital. But at this point in time, there were still plenty of people that were tradesmen, you know, cobblers, people that, you know, may have grown some of their food, but they didn't have, you know, wheat fields. They didn't have a lot. Some people were actually living in the city. So they, you know, they surrendered some of the important things of life for the convenience of being close to work and, you know, not having to grow anything for themselves, and because they maybe they made a little bit more money because they needed to be able to buy those types of things. So they actually had to provide for themselves throughout the winter until, you know, food became abundant again. They didn't have an international shipping of, you know, as soon as the fruit isn't available in America, they go to South America and start importing the fruit. That wasn't happening.
Right.
So there was a real limitation on subsistence and being able to survive. And many people, you know, this was their liquid bread.
Now, wow. Okay.
They did start intensifying it, and it got stronger and stronger. And if you look at it, why was the Prohibition movement so big, and why was it such a national crisis? Because so many people were drinking, because they got consumed by the alcohol. Instead of, you know, having to drink lots of it, they only had to drink a little bit.
You know, there was something else I learned that a lot of people don't know, is that farmers, during the era of the Model T, you could fill up your Model T with alcohol or gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
You could use either. And so many people used it. It was so useful. There were people who used it as a fuel.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I'd heard that as well. So anyway, here's kind of the background, and as a matter of fact, this is kind of a cut and paste and amalgamation of a few different sources, but anyway. The Whiskey Rebellion was a 1794 uprising of farmers and distillers in western Pennsylvania in protest of a whiskey tax enacted by the federal government. Following years of aggression with tax collectors, the region finally exploded in a confrontation. Following years of aggression with tax collectors. Now, who was being aggressive? Was the tax collectors being aggressive? And so the region finally exploded in a confrontation that resulted in President Washington sending in troops to quell what some feared would be a full-blown revolution. Opposition to the whiskey tax and the rebellion itself built support for the Republicans, who overtook the Federalist Party for power. Now, I'm just reading. This is from the History Channel, folks. So the Federalist power basically overtook the Federalist power, or the Federalist Party for power, in 1802. And we know that actually that was 1800. And it's interesting that they actually made the mistake of calling them the Republicans, didn't they?
They did. They did do that.
You know, sometimes people just don't realize what they put out there, that they actually support the truth instead of, oh, you know, the History Channel actually should be supporting the narrative that it was the Democratic Republicans. But, whoops. Anyway, the Whiskey Rebellion.
Every once in a while, the truth sneaks out.
It just slips out. The Whiskey Rebellion is considered one of the first major tests of the authority of the newly formed U.S. government. As I have been telling you, that the individual states incurred significant debt from the Revolutionary War, in 1790, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton pushed for the federal government to take over that debt. He also suggested an excise tax on whiskey to prevent further financial difficulty. President Washington was opposed to Hamilton's suggestion of a whiskey tax, and in 1791, Washington journeyed through Virginia, Pennsylvania to speak because he hadn't signed the bill yet. So he basically journeyed around into Pennsylvania and other states and spoke with citizens about their views. Local government officials met the idea of a whiskey tax with enthusiasm, and Washington took his assurance back to Congress, which passed the bill. Apparently, Washington didn't go far enough west into Pennsylvania.
Right.
But he did the due diligence and protests. He did some due diligence, but protests against the new tax began immediately, arguing that the tax was unfair to small producers. Under the new law, large producers paid the tax annually at a rate of 6 cents per gallon. And the more they produced, the further the tax breaks. However, some small producers were stuck with paying 9 cents per gallon on taxes. Framers took further issues because only cash would be accepted for payment. So anyway, now we kind of start on the whiskey, the whiskey tax. And so this is where this is kind of rough reading because this is kind of how I've stitched a lot of things together. But I think it'll go pretty clear because this is the timeline of how the Whiskey Rebellion went down. So go ahead.
All right. Is this still from the History Channel? Or
No. This is actually from different sources, but go ahead.
Okay. The whiskey tax. The law was immediately a failure since refusals to pay the taxes were as common as intimidation against officials hired to collect them. Excise officers sent to collect the tax were met with defiance and threats of violence. Violence broke out on September 11th, 1791. Excise officer Robert Johnson was riding through his collection route in western Pennsylvania when he was surrounded by 11 men dressed as women. Considering the day, I thought that just caught me by surprise. The mob stripped him naked and then tarred and feathered him before stealing his horse and abandoning him in the forest. Johnson recognized two men in the mob. He made a complaint and warrants were issued for their arrest. A cattle driver named John Connor was sent with the warrants, and he suffered the same fate as Johnson. He was tied to a tree in the woods for 5 hours before being found. In response, Johnson resigned his post, fearing further violence. Incidents escalated over the next few years, and in 1793, the home of Pennsylvania excise officer Benjamin Wells was broken into twice. The first time, a mob of people forced their way in and assaulted Wells' wife and children. The second incident involved six men in disguises who attacked Wells while he was at home. The intruders demanded Wells' account books at gunpoint and insisted he resign his position. Feeling unrepresented in Congress, the citizens of western Pennsylvania gathered their own assembly with 3 to 5 representatives per county. While radical members pushed for open rebellion, moderates like Hugh Henry Breckinridge and future Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Albert Gallatin urged conciliatory measures. In the summer of 1794, Federal Marshal David Lennox began the process of serving writs to 60 distillers in western Pennsylvania who had not paid the tax. On July 14th, Lennox accepted the services of tax collector and wealthy landowner John Neville as guide through Allegheny County.
Okay, so some of the things that we've garnered here is obviously it took a little while. There were some incursions, but, you know, going back up, that there was a, you know, an incident where men went to, Benjamin Wells, where his home was broken into twice, and his wife and children were harassed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, things are kind of going, wow, this is more than just a protest.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But technically, it's not. This is an insurgency because bottom line, it could not be argued that the federal government couldn't do this.
Right.
Right. In other words, not once did somebody actually take the civil approach and say, where is this power, and petition the government and say, hey, you can't do this, or where do you get off doing this? No, mm-hmm. These people didn't like it. And this is why I mentioned, in the previous episode about the enemies of government.
Okay.
There you go. Go ahead. So the attack on John Neville's home.
John Neville's home, Bower Hill.
Mm-hmm.
On July 15th, they approached the home of William Miller, who refused to accept the summons. An argument ensued, and when Lennox and Neville rode off, they were face-to-face with an angry mob armed with pitchforks and muskets. Someone had told the mob that federal agents were dragging people away, but Lennox and Neville were allowed to pass once that was understood to be untrue. Nonetheless, a shot was fired as the two men rode away. On the morning of July 16th, Neville was asleep in his home, Bower Hill, when he was awakened by a crowd of angry men, some of whom had been served summons the previous day. The men claimed that Lennox needed to come with them because there was a threat to his life. Neville didn't believe the men and ordered them off his property. When the men refused to move, Neville grabbed a gun and shot at the crowd, striking and killing Oliver Miller. In retaliation, the mob shot back at the house. Neville made it inside the house and sounded a signal horn, after which he heard the sound of his slaves attacking the crowd with firearms. Six members of the mob were wounded before they fled with Miller's body. By evening, the mob had reconvened for a meeting with a group of other people who declared revenge on Neville. Before you go anywhere.
Right.
This is interesting because, first of all, he had some kind of alarm, a signal horn.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then his slaves, who were armed, defended his property. Now, I don't know. It sounds unusual to me. Okay.
Now this. So this was in Western Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Okay.
This was a farm setting.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously he was an industrious man. He probably had a farm.
Right.
And there were probably servants there that they may have referred to as slaves. But they may not have been bound slaves. In other words, they were, they were probably more like serfs.
Okay.
Instead of actually slaves.
Okay, because it uses the term slaves.
Right, because that was just a common term. Because why do you think that they use the term slave regarding these folks? Because they don't mention the color of their skin. But that's there you go. Because I think that because they were black servants, they were probably more like serfs or a family or a couple of families that were being taken care of by the industry of the home.
So we can't assume that just because they were slaves, they were black.
That is true. Nor can we assume that they were really slaves. They were just called slaves that defended the home. Because in all context, most slaves are never given arms.
Right. That's what stood out to me.
Okay.
What I thought was strange.
Okay. So you could assume that they weren't black, but I would probably say that they may have been. And so what was Western Pennsylvania at the time?
Oh, Western Pennsylvania was...
What is Western Pennsylvania today?
Well, it's... I'm not sure where you're going with the question. It's not considered the South. But and it's fairly liberal, if that's where you're going. I should tell you that I have some family history from Pennsylvania. A lot of those people were Quakers, and in fact, they didn't believe in slavery. So, other than that, I don't know where you're going with the question. What is Western Pennsylvania today?
Okay. Yeah. So what's west of Pennsylvania?
Oh, Ohio.
There you go. So they were actually talking about Ohio.
Oh.
There we go. Okay. So going back up, they were talking about the lack of representation. And I think you kind of missed that because, Ohio hadn't had representation yet.
Oh.
Because it was now truly a territory, even though it was a part of Pennsylvania. You know, so when they created Vermont and when they created Kentucky and Tennessee, those were actually states that were being, they were territories of the states that actually had counties and so forth. And they were saying, okay, it's time to, you know, create, break that state off of this state. Ohio wasn't so fortunate.
So Ohio, which wasn't a state until, I think, 1817, if I'm not mistaken, Ohio then was Western Pennsylvania.
That is correct. And at this point in time, I believe it was identified as a territory, and territories didn't have representation.
Okay, this begs my next question. If they didn't have representation, okay, well, we, you know, the United States had the authority to make laws in the territories, right?
Or okay. Yes, they did, but they couldn't have representation. In other words, what was the Revolutionary War fought over?
Taxation without representation.
There you go. So these guys were saying, hey, we're being taxed without any representation. Mm-hmm. Now you see the point? Because yep. Ohio actually became a state in 1803. So it was It was another decade away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
right. I should have known that too.
So they basically were kind of suffering with all of these rules and taxation when technically they didn't have to tax those people in the territories.
Right.
But they did. And that was Hamilton.
Mm. In other words, so this, got it. That's much more clear. Much more clear. And we have to remember the United States then didn't look like what it does today. Okay?
Right.
So when you said Western Pennsylvania, the map in my head was not the map of the time. Thanks for clarifying that.
That's no problem. Okay, so, and it's always important because people always use their current context when they're reading things. You have to really go back and put everything into the proper perspective. And, you know, we're all guilty. Even I'm guilty of, you know, kind of marginalizing some of these things. So
mm-hmm.
Now we're going into the destruction of the Bower Hill,
All right. On July 17, 1794, as many as 700 men marched to drums and gathered at Neville's home. They demanded his surrender. But Major James Kirkpatrick, one of the 10 soldiers who had come to the property to help defend it, answered that Neville was not there. In fact, Kirkpatrick had helped Neville escape the house and hide in a ravine. The mob demanded that the soldiers surrender. When that request was refused, they set fire to a barn and slave dwellings. The Neville women were allowed to flee to safety, after which the mob opened fire on the house. Following an hour of gunfighting, the mob's leader, James McFarlane, was killed. In a rage, the mob set fire to the other buildings, and the soldiers soon surrendered as the Bower Hill estate burned to the ground.
Okay, so less than a minute. Now we're going to basically watch everything kind of progress from here. So this is all about the people in Ohio that didn't have representation, but they were being taxed, and they felt that this was heavy-handed government. The federal government had the power to tax whom?
Citizens of the United States.
Actually, right? So... No, they
the states.
There you go.
Tax the states. Uh-huh. What was I thinking?
Right.
What?
Right. Even they though this is a legitimate. So when they tax when the direct taxes are laid to the states are done by apportionment. But this wasn't a direct tax, or I should say a duty. So what this was, we're going into breakdown. So what this really was an excise tax, and Hamilton wanted to apply this to everywhere in the Union, because had he gone into only applying this into the states, it would have driven people out into the territories to buy their whiskey or to do their whiskey business and, you know, and play those, because that's what people do. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance.
In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so for those who really know geography, Bower Hill is right there in Pittsburgh. And where is Pittsburgh, by the way, Paul? Do you happen to know physically?
Well, Pittsburgh is in western Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh. Extreme right. Western.
Right?
Right. I mean, it's right there by the border.
Okay,
so it would make sense that if you're going to be a family man, and you want to have, you know, some, I'll just say, some creature comforts of society or civilization, you want to probably live as close as you possibly can to a major city. So when you look at the territory of Ohio, I mean, the savages were still kind of out there, but the farmers and other people may have been further out. But that was the extent, or that was the portal to the West. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. So it makes sense that he was actually in Pennsylvania, but those who were being taxed, I believe he was traveling further west out into the Ohio Valley. And so when we really look at what's happening, the threat to Pittsburgh now happens because now we can we can see this kind of come into fruition.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So a threat to Pittsburgh less than a week later. The mob met with local dignitaries who warned that Washington would send a militia to strike them down, and they had to strike first. Wealthy landowner David Bradford, along with several other men, attacked a mail carrier and discovered three letters from Pittsburgh expressing disapproval of the attack on Neville's property. Bradford used these letters as an excuse to encourage an attack on Pittsburgh, inciting 7,000 men to show up at Braddock's Field east of the city. The city of Pittsburgh, fearing violence, sent a delegation to announce that the three-letter writers had been expelled from the city and to offer a gift of several barrels of whiskey.
Keep going.
And by the way, the gift was accepted because as the day ended, the crowd had drunk deeply from the barrels and weren't inspired to descend on Pittsburgh with any fury, instead gaining permission to march through Pittsburgh peacefully.
Yeah, you mean stumble through peacefully.
Yes.
Okay.
So next, go ahead. Did you want to introduce yourself?
No. That's fine. Everything's set in motion.
All right. So Washington sends the militia with signs that the rebels were hoping to reignite the conflict and believing it was linked to unrest in other parts of the country. Hamilton wanted to send troops to Pennsylvania, but Washington opted for peace envoy instead.
Okay.
I like this.
Okay.
I think this was important. Right?
Right.
Washington didn't immediately want to send troops. He wanted an understanding, or he wanted to make peace, or he wanted to have at least a dialogue.
He wanted to avoid having to use a forced conflict, deadly force, with fellow Americans. He didn't want to mar his presidency with that kind of engagement. But
sure.
Who did? Who said, let's just go ahead and be brutes?
Hamilton.
The creature.
Let's do this thing. Let's go get him.
The creature. That's correct.
What'd you say? Was that the nickname that Jefferson and Madison?
Jefferson and Madison. Yeah, they referred to him as the creature. Yes. So.
Okay.
Right. I mean, here he is instigating. You know, he's actually putting, you know, he's creating drama that Washington didn't want to do. And Washington basically had to suppress him and say, look, this is what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And I'll bet you anything, okay. Hamilton was probably out there with that peace envoy. Go ahead.
All right. The peace envoy failed. Washington met with his cabinet officials and presented evidence of the violence to Supreme Court Justice James Wilson, who ruled a military response was justified under the auspices of the Militia Acts of 1792. I'd like to get those, by the way.
Yeah, so I actually have that, but that go ahead.
Okay. All right. Washington assumed emergency power to assemble more than 12,000 men from the surrounding states and eastern Pennsylvania as a federal militia. Now, quick question here. Uh-huh. Now, we're not declaring war.
Nope.
Because he has power to call forth the militia. Well, no, Congress has power to call forth the militia.
Okay, so that's the whole point of the Militia Acts.
Right.
So the Militia Act gave the president, at this point in time, because they already saw the Whiskey Rebellion as something that was going to continue to grow, they went ahead and created an act that allowed Washington to call forth, basically abdicating their responsibility and saying, oh, you know what, if you're not ready, because I think they were going to call him up. And they said, no, don't call him up. I don't want him. And they said, oh, okay, well, if you don't want him now, then we're just going to pass this act so that you can call him up later, whenever you want.
Mm.
And that's what ended up happening. So keep going.
Okay. Washington assumed emergency power to assemble more than 12,000 men from the surrounding states and eastern Pennsylvania as a federal militia.
Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to go through the Militia Act right here. Go ahead.
Ah, okay. All right, so here we go.
Hold on. So we're going to go through the Constitution, the militia, and all of that. So go ahead. You'll see how this lays out.
In Section 8 of the Constitution, the power to call forth the militia was expressly given to Congress. But only 2 years into George Washington's presidency, the Second Congress temporarily delegated its authority under the First Militia Clause by passing a statute, quote, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, end quote. The Militia Act of 1792 was meant to be a three-year-long experiment, but gave the president broad power to call out the militia. Section 1 of the Act covered foreign invasions and imminent dangers from a foreign nation and met little resistance in Congress. On the other hand, Section 2, which dealt with suppressing insurrection, met with much resistance on the floor of Congress. After much debate, additional amendments were added requiring judicial intervention and that the president must first order the insurgents to disperse. 2 years after the Act was passed, President Washington called for the militia to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion. Now, in terms of a timetable, this thing happened. This thing was taking place over a couple of years.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
what you suggested mm-hmm. is people saw something like this coming,
mm-hmm.
or the Congress did, and wanted to prepare for it.
Yep. Yes. And what they did was they made it possible for Washington to just move forward, to act, instead of waiting because Congress may not have been in session at the time. As a matter of fact, Congress wasn't together that often. They were only, if you really look at how long they were working, it was short.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. In fact, I think one of the things that I heard about is that the Congress had anticipated that they might have enough work to do to meet one day a year. Okay. I don't remember where I heard that, but it's not as much as they do now. Okay. So in Washington's sixth State of the Union address, he recounted the actions that he took. First, Washington followed the Constitution and the Militia Act by first seeking and receiving certification from the Supreme Court. Okay. So he says Constitution and the Militia Act, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then, quote, upon testimony of these facts, an associate justice of the Supreme Court of the United States notified me that, quote, in the counties of Washington and Allegheny in Pennsylvania, laws of the United States were opposed and the execution thereof obstructed by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings or by the powers vested in the marshal of the district, end quote. Second, Washington issued a proclamation commanding the insurgents to disperse. I postponed, therefore, the summoning of the militia immediately into the field, but I required them to be held in readiness, that if my anxious endeavors to reclaim the deluded and to convince the malignant of their danger should be fruitless, military force might be prepared to act before the season should be too far advanced.
Right. So what you're reading is his actual account, like it says before, in his State of the Union address. So he recounts all of this stuff. So what you're reading in those quotations are actually out of that State of the Union address.
These are Washington's words.
Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
My proclamation of the 7th of August last, 1794, was accordingly issued and accompanied by the appointment of commissioners who were charged to repair to the scene of insurrection, end quote. Finally, the president assembled the militia to quell the rebellion. Quote, thus the painful alternative could not be discarded. I ordered the militia to march after once more admonishing the insurgents on my proclamation of the 25th of September last, end quote. Washington was distraught that the military force had to be used against his own countrymen, but he was very happy to report that the rebellion was over. The event itself was disgraceful and required a significant portion of the country's resources, but it proved that our prosperity rested on a solid foundation of citizens who understood the true principles of liberty. While there is cause to lament, I think this is a quote.
So yeah, this quote, is a quote.
Is this Washington?
Mm-hmm. Yep, this is him.
While there is cause to lament that occurrences of this nature should have disgraced the name or interrupted the tranquility of any part of our community or should have diverted to a new application any portion of the public resources, there are not wanting real and substantial consolations for the misfortune. It has demonstrated that our prosperity rests on solid foundations by furnishing an additional that my fellow citizens understand the true principles of government and liberty, that they feel their inseparable union, that notwithstanding all the devices which have been used to sway them from their interest and duty, they are not as ready to maintain the authority of the laws against licentious invasions as they were to defend their rights against usurpation, end quote.
You know, that that's interesting, almost like an indictment, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Notwithstanding all the devices which have been used to sway them from their interest and duty, they are not as ready to maintain the authority of the laws against licentiousness, invasions, as they were to defend their rights against usurpation. So here we're watching an invasion on our southern border, and nobody is actually doing anything about this. And even today, we're not even willing to stand up against the encroachments on our rights.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this is just really an indictment of how far we have slid as a society. But keep going.
Commander-in-Chief George Washington could not have been prouder of the militiamen that he called forth and marched 300 miles to Pennsylvania. Quote, it has been a spectacle displaying to the highest advantage of Republican government to behold the most and the least wealthy of our citizens standing in the same ranks as private soldiers, preeminently distinguished by being the army of the Constitution, undeterred by a march of 300 miles over rugged mountains, by approach of an inclement season, or by any other discouragement, end quote.
Okay. So was this the militia?
This is the militia.
No, it was the army of the Constitution. They were federalized. They created an army to do one specific job.
Okay, right.
Okay.
So let me put it this way. I meant it was.
They're synonymous.
The way he describes them.
No. I want to point out that they are synonymous, but most people really do separate the army and the militia. And they're synonymous. They're supposed to be the same. As I've said several times, the army is not to be deployed off this continent.
There's something else that's I think distinguished, really important here, and the way Washington describes this, because we don't understand it. You're right. An army is not supposed to be deployed outside of this continent or outside of a country. But he did. But we have what we, in a time of need, we have a militia that has become the army for a specific purpose.
Yep.
And it was done.
That's right.
It was done. Then they went back to being the militia. But then he describes it has been a spectacle displaying the highest advantage of Republican government to behold the most and the least wealthy of our citizens standing the same ranks as private soldiers.
Right. Okay. Yes. Where in today, you know, if you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth, you don't serve. Like Bill Clinton, or actually he didn't have the protection of a family. He just ran to another nation.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. I mean, that's why he went to England to go to school.
To be a Rhodes Scholar, right?
Mm-hmm. That was his excuse in not serving. Yep. Keep going there.
Right. Yeah. Washington was also proud and wanted to thank the patriotic support he received from the governors. Quote, "Nor ought I to omit to acknowledge the efficacious and patriotic cooperation which I have experienced from the chief magistrates of the states to which my requisitions have been addressed."
And so, and I have a problem with what he said. He had a paradigm. He had the paradigm of a government of magistrates.
Right. He used the term magistrate.
He actually used that term. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he had a problem, understanding the Republican form of government, and that under this new government model, these were executives. They weren't magistrates. There's a huge difference. Okay. Because the magistrate is an all-powerful, body or being. You know, the Continental Congress was the magistrate because it had executive, judiciary, and legislative. But the most power of the power is legislative.
And it's the governors, I believe, that he's referring to, mm-hmm. but he's referring to them as chief magistrates.
Yes.
And thinking in terms of governors, what I hear Washington saying, if we use it in that context, is that the system worked.
Uh-huh.
The system worked the way it was supposed to work. And then he goes on, because he says, above all, he wanted to give praise to every citizen of America for their affection and vigilant support of the Constitution. Oh, my.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, "To every description of citizens, let praise be given, but let them persevere in their affectionate vigilance over that precious depository of American happiness, the Constitution of the United States. Let them cherish it, too, for the sake of those who, from every clime, are daily seeking a dwelling in our land." I'll continue.
Yeah. So obviously, this is skipping back and forth between editorializing and then what he says, editorializing and then following exactly what he says. So, it's like a view of what he's going to say, and this is what he says. A view of what he's going to say. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. "And when all was said and done, he hoped they would realize that this insurrection was based upon ignorance and false accusations of their government." Quote, "And when in the calm moments of reflection they shall have retraced the origin and progress of the insurrection, let them determine whether it has not been fomented by combinations of men who, careless of consequences and disregarding the inerring truth that those who rouse cannot always appease a civil convulsion, have disseminated from an ignorance or perversion of facts, suspicions, jealousies, and accusations of the whole government," end quote. GR. Washington has a tendency to speak, I've read where he speaks something like a paragraph, without a breath,
uh-huh.
and no period. Okay. And mm-hmm. so this is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But I would actually have to
Reread what he said.
I read it out loud. I would actually have to read it again.
He's backhanding those people who basically roused this movement of uprising against the government. I mean, clearly, you know, they were doing what they needed to do. The government was within its bounds, and you know, these guys were really the problem.
But now there was. It can't be lost that there was a right way to have done this, okay? And that is, you know, we have actually the example of the Declaration of Independence, okay? And this part where it says that there are many petitions, okay? Uh-huh. So, you know, we didn't start by going to war. We had petitioned.
Right.
The king multiple times and the petitions have been ignored. And so, you know, understanding, I know they had this history, this background. I know that, you know, maybe the immediate shock of being taxed, even if they were in the territories, the immediate shock of being taxed probably riled them up. But then they said, you know, who would have thought, well, look, the Constitution gives us a redress. We need to respond to this and explain and petition the government. That would have been the right way.
That is correct. So,
because what happens, people were killed in this rebellion.
Right. So, correct.
Okay?
So,
property was destroyed.
So, that's what those people who didn't like what was happening, that's what they should have done. The only thing I would have changed differently is that Congress should have waited until Washington was ready to, you know, to execute the militia, and then they should have called forth the militia when that time came. In other words, they should never have passed the Militia Act to basically give him that carte blanche, because you're going to see that they open it up again in 95. But
okay,
so, you know, things weren't perfect, but they did follow the Constitution as close as possible. That's my point. But
okay,
you're right. But the people themselves, they had already forgotten the importance. And I really wish Washington would have brought up the fact that not once did you petition us.
Right. Correct.
Right. Okay.
That's another point, too. Yeah, no one brought that fact up that I know of.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, not even Madison.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So where were we?
Now it was time for Congress. Yep.
Okay. Now it was time for Congress to amend the laws and make the Militia Act of 1792 permanent.
Uh-huh.
What better and more honorable way was there for Congress to thank the citizens of America than to give the president full and lasting power to call for the militia to suppress insurrections and repel invasions?
Right. These aren't my editorials here, but keep going. Yep.
Okay. Quote, having thus fulfilled the engagement which I took when I entered into office, quote, to the best of my ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, end quote, on you gentlemen and the people by whom you are deputed, I rely for support. In the arrangement to which the possibility of a similar contingency will naturally draw your attention, it ought not to be forgotten that the militia laws have exhibited such striking defects as could not have been supplied by the zeal of our citizens. What does he mean here, such striking defects?
So this is what I was saying, that if what do you do if Congress is in session and we have an insurrection?
Mm-hmm.
How do they call forth Congress out of rest or out of, you know, on break and call them into an emergency session? Those things don't exist, right? And
right.
So this is why they felt it necessary to go down this path. I'm telling you that they needed to amend the Constitution. It would have been far better for them to amend and give the president the ability to call forth Congress to do their job if necessary. In other words, require Congress to assemble in an emergency. But even then, in those days, it would have taken time.
Right.
Right. I get it. I understand, but doing it right would have been the best way. Keep going.
Sure. Besides the extraordinary expense and waste, which are not the least of the defects, every appeal to those laws is intended with a doubt on its success. The devising and establishing of a well-regulated militia would be a genuine source of legislative honor and a perfect title to public gratitude. I therefore entertain a hope that the present session will not pass without carrying, hang on, I lost my place, without carrying to its full energy the power of organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and thus providing in the language of the Constitution for calling them forth to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
Right. Okay, and so now he's pointing out that the fact was is that they haven't been doing a good job in just that. Arming, disciplining, and training, all of these things, organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. So he's kind of pointing out that the federal government isn't driving that either. Just like they didn't do anything with the Navy, they weren't doing anything with the militia.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Was it a feeling of, okay, well, first of all, we're kind of an isolated country now. I mean, there are two seas. We got seas on both sides of us. Was a feeling, maybe?
Well, so
maybe, you know, they had been through a revolution. They're not fighting. And now, oh, let me just take a deep breath.
Yeah. You know? So there's that. There's that. But to be clear, I don't think Washington murmured much about the Navy. But clearly, he had a little dig here that we need, because this is his army. This is right. His army. And he sure. wanted to make sure that we had a better army than what he had. Okay. And yes. So he, you know, here was the point of being able to poke, you know, both Congress and the states in the eye and say, you guys aren't doing your job.
Right.
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 And had they gone, had they actually responded and done something more than what they did and actually got really organized, I honestly think that the future of America would be a lot different today.
Yeah, okay. I see.
So we got one minute left, by the way.
I think it was just not a sense of urgency. We're so far from foreign entanglements after the revolution, at least before the War of 1812, that maybe the urgency didn't seem to be there. I wondered.
Yeah, so it's not that they didn't think that they would ever need to be called up again. Washington knew, and he was a smarter man than that, and he used this as political leverage to basically tell the people, we need to be doing better. We need to have an army that can defend us. It's one, you know, the Navy's a little bit different, but it's more important, especially when, you know, we're so dependent on our global trade. But anyway, thank you. Any other comments? We get 5 seconds.
Looking forward to wrapping this up. This has been an interesting one. We just had a little bit to go.
I'm sorry, you were saying?
I said, well, looks like we just had a little bit to go, but we'll finish it up, I guess, and we'll see you next time.
All right, thank you so much. God bless. Well, folks, this is G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.